Good morning. It's wonderful, as always, to see your faces, to sit together. So this week, I was inspired by the words of Parsha Vaera to reflect on the ephemeral nature of knowing, of feeling like we know or understand anything, but particularly the ephemeral nature of knowing what we mean by Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, God, the source of life, or however you refer to the emptiness that holds us when we rest in awareness. So, to understand the context of this Torah reading, I'll go back to where we left off in the story last week with the failed and humiliating attempt by Moses to fulfill the task of liberating his people from Pharaoh. Moses' first attempt of many to convince Pharaoh to let the people go, to free them from oppression, ended up making them more oppressed. In response to Moses' request, Pharaoh had made it harder for the Israelites to meet their war quotas, so the people were even more miserable and bitter toward Moses. They went to Moses and Aaron, saying, "May the Lord punish you for making us loathsome to Pharaoh, putting a sword in their hand to slay us." So Moses said to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, "Why did you bring harm upon this people? Why did you send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has dealt worse with this people, and still you have not delivered your people." And then God promises Moses, "You shall soon see what I will do to Pharaoh because of a greater might. He will not only let them go, but he shall drive them from his land." So that's the end of the previous Torah reading and the context for the first and very mysterious line of this week's Torah reading. God spoke to Moses and said to him, "I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. I was seen by Abraham, by Yitzhak, and by Yaakov as El Shaddai, but my name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, was not known to them." You might think, oh, this is the first time God is referring to God's self with the mysterious, unpronounceable magic letters, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. God appears to Abraham and Isaac as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the narrator says, but introduces God's self to Abraham and Isaac with the name El Shaddai or Elohim in the book of Genesis. However, when Jacob has his dream of the stairway reaching to the sky, we read, "Here was Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh standing beside him, saying, Ani Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh." So God did introduce God's self to Jacob as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So it's not literally true that God has not ever used the words Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh to make God's self known to the forefathers. So there has to be some other meaning. Commentators like Rabbi Jonathan Sacks make the important observation that God is, for the first time, introducing God's self as someone who has heard the cries of the people and in response will intervene in the political landscape, will be the force of liberation. So it is here that God defines God's self as the greater power that will liberate the Israelites. Moses goes to God to report his weakness, his failure, and God says, "Don't worry, you don't have to do this yourself. I will be doing it. Go back to the people and tell them, I will bring you out from beneath the burdens of Egypt. I will rescue you from servitude to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. I will take you for me as a people, and I will be for you your God. And you shall know that I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, who brings you out from beneath the burdens of Egypt." But when Moses told this to the Israelites, They did not listen because of their shortness of spirit and hard servitude. Now, I put together these ideas before I had the chance to listen to Reb Moshe's recorded talk from last week, since I couldn't be here last week. And when I listened to it yesterday, I was delighted that Reb Moshe also focused on Mitzrayim, Egypt, as representing the narrowness, the limitations of living in a physical world, and Exodus as symbolic of the soul's desire to connect with the divine, to be liberated from the limitations of our material preoccupations. And I was delighted to have that Kabbalistic interpretation as background, because today thoughts that I had already put together were on the Buddhist perspective on the path to liberation. A parallel path. So it's clear that Moses is perceiving Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as the promise of liberation, and the people are not able to perceive that because of their shortness of spirit. So how one perceives Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God, evidently depends on the state of mind and the role of the perceiver. The forefathers had not known God in this way, as their roles were not the same as Moses. They were not designated as a shepherd, a guide to the people. And the Israelites were not able to understand this liberation aspect of God because their spirits were contracted. Miksei Ruach, spirits were in a narrow place. As in other places in our prayers and our liturgy and Torah, we hear that God appears differently to different people and differently depending on the context, the perceiver, and the condition of the perceiver's spirit at any moment. In the Amidah, a prayer intended for repetition each morning, and also these words are repeated each afternoon and evening, we say, Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu ve'Elohei Avotenu ve'Imotenu Elohei Avraham Elohei Yitzhak Elohei Yaakov Elohei Sarah Elohei Rivka Elohei Rachel ve'Elohei Leah. And it's not, we don't just say the God of our ancestors, we refer to God as having a relationship with each of the different forefathers and foremothers, reflecting that God is perceived by individuals. Thus, God has many names and many descriptors. Even within the Amidah, there are many descriptors. Great, mighty, and awesome God, God Most High, who bestows loving kindness and goodness. Okay, so it's compassionate, who creates everything, who remembers the good deeds of our forebears, who will lovingly bring a redeemer to their children, redeemer, helper, shield, all of these different descriptors. And countless other references in our tradition affirm the personal experience of the ungraspable, ephemeral nature of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, a name that we only point to these four consonants. So it's a name that only points us in a certain direction. No vowels, unpronounceable, a breath, a wind. We can't describe what God looks like. We can only refer to what God is not. So this week's teaching, linking the concept of God to liberation, resonates for me with some Buddhist teachings about what is the path to liberation. For here in Torah, Ehye Asher Ehye, the name represented by Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, is itself, in this parsha, a symbol for liberation from forms, signs, and certainty about knowing anything as solid, separate. I will be there, however I will be there. So, of course, Rabbi Jeff Roth has helped us out by giving us a way to articulate this ever-changing nature of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. We often refer to this as the unfolding of being in each moment, the unfolding of reality, what we perceive in each moment when we step back and take in the big picture rather than being preoccupied with the specific things we need to struggle with, like two-factor identification to get into some email or something. We are always, at every moment, potentially resting in the unfolding of being. But of course, we have to practice doing this, returning our attention to that over and over in order to have even a fleeting second of this restful awareness during daily life. So, as much as I've made use of Jeff Roth's explanation of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in our teachings, I hadn't previously focused as much on the ephemeral nature of our own ability to know anything about who we are, where we come from, and what we are doing here. But with the help of writings and talks by Thich Nhat Hanh, Jack Kornfield, and Norman Fisher, I feel more able to embrace the experience of knowing and not knowing as part of our practice. So, in an essay in the magazine The Lion's Roar, Thich Nhat Hanh explains the three doors of liberation, which are taught in every Buddhist tradition. So, I reviewed these hoping to understand what it can teach us about the Book of Exodus and the representation of God as the force of liberation. In Zen teachings, these three doors are emptiness, signlessness or formlessness, and aimlessness. Contemplating these three profound truths, says Thich Nhat Hanh, can liberate us, or at least lessen our fear and suffering. Emptiness, he writes, is not a philosophy. It's a description of reality. Emptiness means that we are empty of a solid, separate self. Every object is empty of a solid separateness. We now know this from physics. This solid table is made up of teeny tiny particles whirling around at incredible speed. And we perceive it as a solid table. Each of us is constantly being impacted by the presence or absence of others in our lives. Our thinking, our mood is not separate from the context of any experience in any moment. I'm able to be compassionate or generous in some moments, but not in other more stressful moments when I'm in miksar ruach, a contracted spirit. The second door of liberation is signlessness or formlessness. It sounds complicated, but all it means is that what we perceive depends more on the perceiving than on some solid separate thing that's out there. Norman Fisher gives a good example. He lives by the ocean on the Pacific coast. He said in a recent talk, "What I perceive as the sea looking out from our house is different from what my wife Kathy experiences as a scuba diver, from what a whale experiences breaching the water to get air, plunging down deep again, what a fish experiences, just as we don't perceive air until it moves, touching our skin with a breeze. Fish may not experience water as a thing." What the ancients have taught through the ages about this, we now understand. I mean, we understand this through cognitive neuroscience. They've been teaching it, you know, for a millennium. Now we get it. What we each perceive is based on the state of our nervous system at any given moment. as our eyes, ears, skin, nose, and mouth come in contact with things and send messages to our brain and give the brain information from which we construct an experience of reality. So when meditation teachers say what we experience as reality is a construction based on our conditioning from the way we've been taught to call certain things by certain names or descriptors. Pretty, ugly, red, blue. This is consistent with what we know from cognitive neuroscience, even though it does fly in the face of what we automatically believe. And finally, aimlessness. This is puzzling, but it does not mean that we stop trying to do anything or give up all our pursuits. Indeed, Thich Nhat Hanh is known for his incredible dedication to working on peace. What does it mean? What it means is that we do not lose sight of what is right here, right now, in order to pursue something that is out of reach, that we think is going to bring us happiness. A very important thing to recognize when we're not achieving what we want, to not lose sight of what's happening right now. He says you may be running after happiness, love, romance, success, or enlightenment, but concentrating on aimlessness consists of removing the object of your pursuit. If you are running after nirvana, you should know that nirvana is already there in yourself and in everything. If you are running after the Buddha, be aware that the Buddha is already in you. If you are seeking happiness, be aware that happiness is available in the here and now. This insight helps you stop running. Only when you stop running can you get the fulfillment and happiness you have been looking for. A wave doesn't have to go and look for water. It is water right in the here and now. A cedar tree doesn't have any desire to be a pine or a cypress or even a bird. It's a wonderful manifestation of the cosmos just as it is. You are the manifestation of the cosmos. You are wonderful just like that. Of course, these are wonderful teachings until you try to apply them to really horrible situations. We can talk about that more. So here we are with these wonderful teachings, which we may for 1 second feel like we understand and then it goes away. So I'll end with a story by Jack Kornfield and a reflection by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Jack Kornfield tells the story of a nun who was very devoted to her training and struggled very effortlessly, as good Zen students do, to achieve enlightenment. She realized that her effort was only making her feel more stuck. So she went to the teacher and asked permission to go on a personal retreat, to climb to the top of the mountain and to be there on her own. He granted her permission and she began the arduous climb. As she was ascending, she saw an old man carrying a large bundle down the mountain. She was not aware that this is Bodhisattva Manjushri, who appears to people only when they are ready to be enlightened. As they cross paths, she looks into his face and recognizes his deep wisdom. So she asks him, "Can you tell me what is enlightenment?" He nods and lets go of the bundle. Suddenly, she experiences a lightness and a great freedom from everything that had been holding her back. It was amazing. And then in the next moment, she felt a sudden confusion. "What now?" she asked. And the old man bent over, picked up the bundle, and started walking down the mountain. Enlightenment is ephemeral, and also we could say you have to know how to stay in touch with that quality of awareness even when you're carrying a great burden. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks also notes the great diversity in how Jews experience any spiritual awareness, any personal idea of God, depending on our upbringing, the family and social connections that sustain us. Rabbi Sacks explains that we are not a people who agree on how to understand God. We are not a people of theology, but a people of halakha, a people who agree on laws that govern our behavior. Now, many of us don't agree with all the laws and don't follow all the laws, but nevertheless, we are part of a Jewish community that generally agrees on when we're going to get together to do certain practices, how we repeat certain parts of the liturgy, and what we celebrate. You come here on Friday morning because this is the time our community meets. We go to Shabbat services on Friday and Saturday, or else we wouldn't be at the services. So we agree on practices, but not on what we think and feel, for that is, as we have seen, as ephemeral as the in-breath and the out-breath.